Initiating Commander's Log Broadcast. Link up complete. Upload successful.
Here we go. This guy having an English muffin. Stack of paper next to him. I wonder if you'll mind if I just nick a little bit. Oh! Hey! Drew! Drew Wager.
John Harper. Commander John Harper, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right, yeah. What are you doing here?
Well, I'm trying to convince people. And it's tough, you know. You've got to enjoy a book. You want to read it on paper, don't you think?
Yeah, I agree. May I join you?
Well, yeah, grab a pew, sit down. See, the problem is, it's all holograms these days. All these kids, their tablets, palm readers, holofact transmitters. I don't know, it's just...
It's the problem of our generation, isn't it?
Certainly is. Yeah. These kids nowadays, you just can't, you just... Oh, please, everybody.
Yeah. That is a nice stack of paper you have there.
200 grams per square meter. Bleached imperial white gold embossed filigree. Nothing but the best for my book, fella. Elite Reclamation's gonna kick ass.
Yeah, well, that sort of sounds great, but I was actually going to buy that paper for myself, for And Hear the Wheel.
Well, it's a buyer's market, my friend. You snooze, you lose. Early bird gets the worm. I better stop using cliches. That's not going to look good in the novel, is it?
No, but your novel isn't even finished yet, though, so what do you need paper for?
Aha! But it is finished, you see. Just about 2 days ago, put the final words in.
Ah. Wow, okay, well, that's awesome, then. But still, it's my paper.
You reckon? You'll have to fight me for it.
Thumb war?
Oh, all right, then. Thumb war it is. 1, 2, 3, 4.
I declare a thumb war. Damn it. Okay, you win. If you're going to have the paper, well, you better tell me about Elite Reclamation then. Give me the stats. Pages, word count, chapter count, number of dead bodies.
Give me the stats. Pages. Well, that's a bit of a weird one, isn't it? Because with A4, which is what I've been typing in, I think it's about 330 or something, but... Yeah, when you do all the double line spacing, all that kind of stuff, it varies up and down a bit. But, I reckon about 330-odd. Words, just short of 120K at the moment, because I've been doing a bit of editing. Chapters, I've got 16, so I'm a bit old school there, long chapters.
Yeah.
And there's a prologue and an epilogue kind of topping and tailing it.
Not bad. You don't have a definitive count of dead bodies there? Just a whole bunch?
Well, it depends. Let me try and work this out. If you count ships, it's impossible because I've got a bit of a space battle at the end and lots of stuff gets trashed, so yeah, that would be impossible to count. Dead bodies, there are a few along the way. I would say there's probably 6 or 7 kind of characters that definitely get spaced, blasted, or shot pieces during the book.
So there's two ends of the spectrum. You can be like George R. R. Martin, you just, you know, kill everyone. Anyone who's got a name is liable to die. Or you can go the other way, when, you know, like Star Trek, when no matter what happens. So you're somewhere in the middle there, I suppose.
Yeah, I will give you one little kind of giveaway. Definitely two of my major characters get spaced in some fashion. So some people who are proper central characters do get killed.
But not you're a tough man. 120k, yes, it's a nice size, so it probably is around 330 pages all up. You've got to have, I don't know what your feelings are in terms of novels. Now, once you start sort of, I mean, I'm about 127, which does feel a bit high. I think once you start getting above 130, it starts to drag unless there actually is enough meat to it.
It does feel right, doesn't it, about that kind of 120 mark. I don't think you'll be too much of a problem with 127. And you'll probably find in the editing you'll get a whole lot of stuff slashed out. I certainly did as I went through. I think that's probably quite a good length because I've just finished reading my book as a book for the first time, and it felt a good length. You know, it took me a few days to read it, and it paced itself quite well. There's a bunch of stuff I need to change, but it did it did feel like a good length. So I think that 120 mark is about right for a kind of novel. You've got enough time to give all the characters a bit of space, enough time for your plot to do its thing, wrap up the loose ends without feeling like you're rushing it and making it a bit contrived. So yeah, that sounds about the right length to me.
And so 120, but you were aiming for 90, if I remember correctly. Like right day one, you were thinking 90K?
Yeah, I aimed at 90 back then because I really was a bit concerned that, I wanted to hit that March 2014 date. And when I backtracked from that, from sort of January when the Kickstarters ended, I thought, that's a lot of work to get done in that time. So I thought I'll be a little bit conservative because having written a few books myself already, I know how fast I can write. And so when I did the maths, it was kind of like, anything over 100K is going to be quite a mission in that sort of time scale. So I thought, I'll be conservative at 90. If I do more than that, then I'll be really, really happy. And it turned out I managed to make it. So that's really good.
So how do you get your writing done during the day? I think I've picked up that you do it on your train ride to and from work. Do you get any other time as well?
Not much. I do a little bit around the edges. We occasionally have some kind of free time on the weekends, but not much, to be honest, because I've got two kids and they keep me pretty busy, and obviously a wife and all those other things. So family, that's the weekend kind of usually sewn up. We got lots of friends and we go out and do stuff. So the weekend is usually not a writing time unless I've kind of made some arrangements to do so. But I'm kind of lucky. I've got a 9-to-5 job that I do in London. But I live about 60 miles away from London, so I just hop on the train in the morning about 7:15. And then I've got an hour's worth of writing time on the way in. And then when I get to finish the day job, I get back on the train about 5:30, and I've got an hour's writing time on the way back again. So I get 2 hours a day. I just slap my headphones on, stick my MP3 on, and I just write. So I get 2 hours done every day, so that equates to about 10 hours a week of dedicated writing clubs. It's actually quite good. And it's time that I would otherwise be wasting anyway, just playing games or having a snooze, or reading a book. So it actually works out quite well. I get kind of a man day per week, pretty much, on top of my day job, which doesn't get in the way of the weekend. So it's kind of win-win, really, all the way around.
Yeah, sounds pretty fantastic. All right, so you just finished. Tell me, you typed in those two words, the end. How did that feel? What was going through your head? Relief?
A sense
of accomplishment?
Yeah, that was definitely a relief. I was like, I've finished this thing that's been... Because I don't know about you, but I mean, you finished yours really fast. I was like, whoa, how did you do that? But mine was quite a long slog from kind of January all the way through to the beginning of September, which is roughly when I thought it was going to end. But there were a couple of times in there where I thought, oh no, I'm really getting stuck here. And I had to kind of backtrack and chuck some stuff out and rewrite some things. And it got a bit of a slog at certain points. But then... I got to the end, and it was like I've actually done it. it was definitely a sense of relief. There was definitely a sense of accomplishment there, but it was relief. It's like, this is actually going to happen. I've actually made it.
Yeah, 120,000 words of coherent words. That's definitely an accomplishment, isn't it?
It is good. I mean, and the other thing that I've also managed on the way is obviously I've been sending two chapters at a time across to the publisher to get their take on it and then incorporating their changes in as I've been going through. So whilst I've got 120K words, that's a kind of half-edited 120K words already. So the story is actually in reasonable shape at this point. In some ways, it's not just a completely rough first draft. It's a first draft, which is quite a lot of editorial input already.
Yeah, so you can almost say it's a first edit or whatever terminology you want to use. It's been reviewed in some shape or fashion.
Yeah, and there's lots of dialogue tweaks and duplicated words and dodgy bits of writing that have been kind of slashed out with a red pen already, which is quite good. Yeah,
something that I don't really focus on it particularly when I'm writing, but in just reading at the moment, I do pick up quite a few times where I've used the same word in the same paragraph like twice, and it just sort of stares out at me like glowing neon lights.
Yeah, it's really bad because you don't notice it when you're writing, do you? You just chuck it in there, and then you come back and read it and think, ooh, that doesn't look good. It does stand like a sore thumb, literally.
So you're finished, and you've said you're reading it as a reader and making sure it feels right to you. So what do you do now? Are you going to have a bit of a break or straight back into edit or get some beta readers? Or
it's gone back to the publisher. They're going to edit, because they got up to chapter 12 last. So they've got the last four chapters to actually kind of do their editing magic on. And then once that's done, they're going to send it back to me to do the corrections on that. Then I'll send it back to them to say, look, there you go. That really is kind of a proper version that you can actually now have a good look at. And then they've promised to read it kind of from beginning to end, a bit like I have, to kind of get a feel for the pace and all that kind of good stuff. And then I think it goes out to, it goes out to a bunch of international alpha readers who will just pick it apart, look for plot holes, give me a hard time on the dialogue and the pacing and the structure and all that kind of good stuff. And once the feedback comes back in from that, then I'm going to have a massive job of kind of dealing with all those bits of criticism. So I'm quite looking forward to that, but it's kind of like quite scary as well. I think you went through a similar process when you sent out to alpha readers. It's suddenly it's in the hands of other people, isn't it? And you're kind of like, whoa, it's coming back.
Yeah, it's funny how some things are important to some people and they care about X and Y, and other people, you know, they accept, oh, that's how it is, but Z upsets them or whatever. So you get this, and they cross over. So, like, some people care about this, but most people don't. And so you think, well, you know, 1 out of 10 people took issue with this, 9 out of 10 thought it was okay or had no comment. What do I do? And you think about, well, if I add one word, you know, maybe I might make him happy, make everyone happy, or to make him happy is too much work. I'll stick with the 90%.
You can't please all the people all the time. I know that's a cliche, but it is true. I had a lot of situations like that with one of my previous books, where I had the Olite one, the Finnis. I got quite a few complaints actually from some of the alpha readers of that one, saying, you know, the heroine in this book, she's been tough all the way through, and then suddenly she's kind of gone a bit weepy. And, you know, she keeps bursting into tears. And I said, well, yeah, but the whole point is that her life's just come apart around her. She, you know, she's entitled to an emotional reaction. That was the point. That was the balance I was trying to get. I was like, I want to make it show up that she's kind of like really upset and, you know, she can't cope anymore. And that's the way she reacts to that. You know, she has been tough all this time, but actually that's been a bit of a facade, and it's all crumbling around her. And that's kind of like, yeah, but we didn't expect her to react like that. Okay, well, now you're seeing a bit more of what she's like. Yeah. But trying to get that balance, really hard, really hard.
Mm. So you talked about your publisher, Fantastic Books, and obviously, as you've heard just recently, I've signed up with them as well.
Yeah, this is really great news, actually. I was Dan, I'll let you into a little secret. Dan did actually just briefly say to me, look, we've got this possibility, do you mind? I said, no, if John's book is up to your standards, you go for it. And it's like, that was like really, really welcome news for me, from my perspective, because I think, you know, we've got this massive uphill climb to get these books into the public eye in the next 6 months. So I think having multiple books from the same publisher gives us quite a lot of credibility. But I mean, it's great news to have you kind of alongside there, because I think you've got the same kind of attitude to promoting and social media and just trying to make as much noise as possible around, you know, around the edges of the elite game, around the, you know, around the fiction. So brilliant news and welcome aboard.
Thanks. I think that one word, noise, making noise, I think that's the thing, isn't it? You have to make as much noise as possible just to get, if you want to get mainstream attention, you've got to, you know, wave your arms and stand up and down and shout and get people interested. And the way you do that these days is through social media.
Yeah, you've got to blow your own trumpet, as we say over here, you know, because nobody's going to do it for you. And you've got to walk a really fine line, actually, between kind of screaming so much that people get fed up with you and screaming enough that you get noticed. Sometimes that line's a bit blurred. It's great to have. I mean, the nice thing about some Fantastic Books is obviously they're a small publisher and they're fairly new to the game, but they're lean, mean and agile, and they seem to have all the contacts in the right places. So, you know, they get the whole ebook thing. They get the whole print on demand thing. Their editors are astonishingly good. I mean, I had a short story published with them last year, and I wrote this short story, which was, I don't know, 1,300 words or something, and I finished it and I edited it myself, and I sent it around to a few friends, and they edited it and did some stuff on it. We thought we'd done a pretty damn fine job because it was a competition. Yeah. And I sent it in. They said, this is great. You know, you're shortlisted for the competition. Fantastic. But these are the editing changes we'd like you to make. Can you make them? And I got this document back, and it was full of red. And I was like looking at it thinking, whoa, I thought I was quite good at this. And here comes that, yeah, but then that's the difference between a real publisher and, you know, just some people who are having a go at it, and the difference in quality between my story when it went in, and my story as it came out of the editing process was like, whoa, this just looks like a, I mean, it was my story, but it just felt so much more professionally polished. It was unbelievable.
I mean, that you see all that red pen, and I don't know about you, but my first instinct is for the heart to just drop. It's like, yeah. Oh, man. But then, you know, once you've sort of gotten over that, damn it, feeling, it's like, oh, man, this is going to make it so much better. And you can learn from what they've done, you know, use that in future work and in future situations.
You never stop learning, do you? I find space battles really hard to write. I don't know about you, but because I get bored with it. Right, turn, fire, shoot, lock a missile, yeah. Shield flaring, laser splashing, you know, all this kind of stuff. So I was trying to find a new way to do the space battle, and I kind of did it from a POV of one of the guys on the bridge. So he can't see everything that's going on. All he can sense is the confusion that's happening because he's not one of the pilots. He's just a passenger. So he doesn't actually understand what a lot of the stuff is. He just knows it's bad. And I was trying to write it from that perspective. Yeah. And then I thought it was quite good, but I sent it through to the editing, and then they chopped it apart. But when it kind of came back together, it was so kind of like, yeah, that's really good. You kind of feel like this guy knows he's going to die. He's just waiting for the end. And you get this really nice, intense kind of experience as reading it, which I was trying to get to, but the editor obviously really honed in on that, and that's the difference an editor makes. It's really, really good.
Yeah, and it's interesting what you say about space battles. I remember looking at the behind-the-scenes work on Star Wars 3, Revenge of the Sith, and, you know, they talked about lightsaber battles, and it's like, well, once you've gone zoom, zoom, zoom for like 30 seconds, you know, what do you do next, you know? And they really have to sort of scratch their heads to, you know, make it, you know, that battle of the heroes at the end is something different and something special and not just the same old thing again. So my sort of strategy was my hero's not the pilot. In general, he's watching what's going on and unable to do anything about it, and he feels quite helpless, and that sort of feeds into some past trauma of his. But I won't go into too much more detail on that. But
no, don't give anything away.
Yeah, sort of going back a step, back to Fantastic Books. See, they've got me, they've got you. That's two books. So I guess the direct immediate comparison is Gallants with their three books.
Yeah, it's interesting that we had that battle footage yesterday, isn't it, with the massive ships firing off, because I felt a bit like we're going to be going in against an Imperial battlecruiser with a couple of Cobras. So.
Yeah.
But the thing is, to go back a little bit on the social media stuff, there's a phrase over here, you may have seen the picture, yeah, on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog.
I haven't heard that one.
Which is kind of just like you can be small, or you can be large, but on the internet, it's anybody's game. I think, these books, the people who play the game who are interested in the fiction are going to be people who are pretty internet savvy. You know, they're going to have a laptop and a computer, and they're going to be completely plugged into, the whole creation of things. You've got whatever the next generation of people who are interested in this game is, they're all going to be young, they're going to be, that's the iPad generation, really. We still have a massive, massive advantage, I think, because you and I have got our books out there, websites are up and running, we've got trailers, we've got podcasts, you've got a fan base that's kind of growing and following us already. And Glantz has got a big impact, no doubt about it, but right now, where are they? They're not there. So, we've got a big head start. So I think we've got a lot of advantages. It'd be interesting to see what starts to happen as we get nearer the launch time, because there are no rumours that I've been able to find about what the Glantz books are, who's writing them, when they're coming out.
They might even be coming out March 2014 at all. Who knows?
Exactly. We do not know. So, as far as I'm concerned, I'm kind of viewing it as a little bit of a land grab, and trying to grab as much kind of internet real estate for official Elite Dangerous novel as possible now, because I know there'll be a fight at some point. But yeah. An eyeball grab. It would be great to be front and center in that. So I think, you and I have got the advantage that we really, really know the Elite universe. We also are well known now to the Elite fans in general. We've got a relationship, a pretty good relationship with Frontier through Michael and the Writers Forum, all that kind of good stuff. So there's a lot of stuff we've got going for us. Frontier also promised to do some kind of joint promotion later on. We don't know what that looks like yet, but that's got to be exciting as well. So, and I'm sure Fantastic Books will have some stuff up their sleeve as well as we get closer as well. So there's plenty of stuff there, and we're just going to have to take the fight to the big boys.
Well, in terms of the actual product, so we've got a publisher who's going to do a professional cover, back cover, copy quotes. They're going to get the reviews out. We're going to have the same quality product in front of the reader as Gallants.
Yes.
The only question is they've got, we're building a fan base and doing social media, and they're not, but that fan base is there waiting because of the name and who they are. But let me ask you something. When I was growing up, we had the set of animal encyclopedias. I think it was about 26 of them or something, A to Z. And when all the books were put together on the bookshelf, the spines made a mosaic of animals in a herd. So sort of transferring that concept slightly, making the elite library, and that's been talked about in the private writers forum, whether we go to all the books having the same mosaic on their spines, or whether just between the two of us obviously having the same design sort of concept behind them all, so that they look like they're a set, or obviously a professional pair or whatever. What do you think about that? Is it fun or tacky?
I think that's quite cool, because I mean, on it adds a bit of kind of, they've really thought about this and they care about the end product kind of effect to it. So I quite like that idea. I mean, it would be awesome if every single, Elite Dangerous novel could share that, but I think that's probably going to be impossible given the number of variations out there. But certainly, if you and I can do that, I think that would be quite cool. It becomes kind of a pair of books, doesn't it? And, from a completely mercenary point of view, if you've got one, then you need to get the other one, don't you?
Absolutely.
To complete your set. So that might not be a bad strategy just from that perspective. But no, I think that's quite cool. It would be really good. I mean, if you can imagine having all the books on your shelf and then they make a Cobra or something, I mean, that would be really, really cool. But whether we could get that organized, I think, I'd be up for that if somebody could organize it, but you'd have to get Gallants and Fantastic and all the other independents to agree on fonts and titling and background images. I think that would be, it wouldn't be impossible, but it would be tough.
Like the RPG books and the rule books, they might be completely different sizes to a regular sort of book.
Yes, because I assume we're going for a sort of standard paperback size, but you never know, it might be possible. But let's see where we can take that one. That sounds like fun. Yeah, from one author to another, what's your feeling for the connectedness of your story to the Elite Universe? What do you find kind of frustrating about not having all the detail yet? Because I mean, I'm a bit stuck with my book in the sense that I've got, I don't know what the weapons are. I don't know what some of the ships are. We've had some detail, but not all of it. And I don't know where these star systems are on the map. And I can't move until I've got that kind of information. I know we're kind of waiting yet. The game comes first, obviously. But it's kind of like, how do you deal with that kind of like, I can't give you another thing because I haven't got the information. I need the information.
I mean, I've given the first five chapters to Dan at Fantastic, and I wasn't happy about it, but there was Travel to __... system, and then they also went to __A** system as well, and just things like that. The star map is the one thing that I really, really want the most. I've used the First Encounters frontier map. I know roughly where I'm starting in terms of, there's the novel basically travels from point A to point B almost, and back to point C, but in terms of A to B is kind of a straight line. I know where it is. I know where it goes through. I know where it finishes. But there's all these other points along the way. I don't know about them. And those points that I know where they are, I know where they are on the frontier map, but I know that's not going to be where they are in the three-dimensional Elite Dangerous map. So, again, I'm sort of stuck. And I can make up names and put them in. But then when the real map comes along, I'm going to have to take them out and redo them. So I've just sort of left them empty for now. I've described systems. If I can't find a system that matches that, I'm going to have to change my descriptions, to match that. But and you can't just stand there paralysed in fear or, not knowing what to do. So I've gone a halfway house of where it's important, I've described what I want to see, and where it's not important, like, who cares what the name of the solar system is, it is what it is. I've left those kind of thing that does sort of, I guess, worry me a bit is the frontier are going to reveal the stories. But they're going to do that at quite a late stage, and everyone's sort of at different places. I think Alan's going to be finishing pretty soon. I don't really have a feel for where Kate is. No one's heard from Boz and Nathaniel in a while.
I got a tweet from Kate actually last week saying she was about three quarters of the way through. So
all right, that's good.
She's making good progress. I think she's planning to publish by the end of the year as well. So she's up up there trying to get in as fast as possible.
Fantastic.
But that's good. It's good.
Yeah, so you got all these different points. Everyone's at different points. Michael needs to review all these things. But, you know, I'm describing, I mean, we've talked about weapons before. That's a, like you've mentioned, is a good example. I've got, basically, my hero's got a modern replica of a 21st century weapon that fires bullets. And other people do have bullet guns, which are generally, you know, in my novel, considered safer on a ship because they bounce off the bulkheads instead of punching a hole through it like lasers. But in saying that, everyone still runs around using lasers anyway. And I know that you're doing different. You're going quite low tech. And this effect happens. And when you shoot someone, this effect happens. And there's not going to be, I don't think there's going to be time or the ability to really put a standard across the board to make everyone's weaponry on the same sort of level.
Yeah. It's going to be a tough one, isn't it? I mean, I kind of thought about that. I mean, my story is set right out on the edge of the frontier. In fact, in a couple of cases, beyond it. I'm kind of assuming out there you're so far away from main civilization that the only technology that you're going to have in mainstream use is stuff that's ultra reliable and easy to fix. It's kind of like your 87 Jeep versus your modern Toyota Prius. You know, the technology's there, but out in the outback, you're just not going to use it because you never get spare parts for it. And it might be flash, and it might be dinky, but you know, it's just not reliable, or it's just too expensive because it's so new. So I'm kind of my guys are kind of the cheap, poor, kind of robust technology. Stuff that's proven, stuff that works, and you don't have to think about it. And that's that. I've kind of chosen that line for my weapons, and in some cases the ships as well. I've kind of gone quite old school there because of the location that I've chosen. So you're not going to have the flash stuff until you get a view of the courses, and you get a small view of that. So there is a place where I kind of explain that. But oddly enough, the one time I use a laser weapon a handheld laser weapon in the story, it doesn't work. And it leaves them in a situation where, my gun doesn't work. And it's like, cheap Federation crap, and he chucks it away. And there's the Leggett. So, it does add a bit of drama, but that's how I've kind of used it.
Ships is another, one that, something that's of interest to me. I've been talking about on the private writers forum. You've probably seen me harping on about it. But we know what ships are going to be in the game, and they don't necessarily fit with what I want in terms of ships for my novel, and so I push Michael, but there's it's hard to find the right balance, and with the amount of ships there are and the amount of writing and novels that we've got, or stories, electronic stories, there was the concern of the place feeling a bit smaller because everyone's wanting to refer to the same ships, because obviously you'd want those game ships in your novel.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, actually. I mean, unfortunately, we can't talk about the list of ships at the moment because it's top secret, but I must admit, I've been a little bit surprised by the list because it does seem to have less mainstream ships, i.e. ships that you kind of imagine would be useful than I expected. There are a few ships in there which, they look great. I mean, they look really cool, but you're kind of thinking, do we need quite so many of that type of ship when the demand for that type of ship, is it really going to be there in the game? I'm not sure. And they're not really useful for the fiction. I mean, the one thing I struggle with is I had to change a couple of my ships after I saw that document because I discovered that the one ship I was going to use didn't have a hyperspace drive. So that that's not going to work. So I had to quickly rethink that one. And then one of the other ships I was using wasn't big enough because I was hoping it could carry another ship, and apparently it can't. So there's details like that I had to swap around, but I kind of needed a really tough sort of modern bounty hunting capable ship. There's the old Asp Explorer from the good old days, but I thought, well, that's going to be maybe a bit old hat, and I'd like something new. And there isn't at the moment a ship that kind of does that well on the Federation side of the world. So, those sort of things, I've put some queries in, but I haven't heard back yet. So it'll be interesting to see how that stuff evolves. But yeah, there's definitely some unanswered questions in that space.
I mean, we're limited by the fact that, Frontier raised X dollars, which allowed them to put X ships into the game. And obviously, when things are successful, not if, and they make money and they put more ships in, then that number's going to expand. But we don't know what that is right now, and we won't know until, that happens a year down the road or whatever. And my main ship is not in the list, which...
Oh, really?
It's going to be a big giveaway to all the alpha readers. but yeah, my main ship is what I want. It's not in the list, and it's the one I keep harping about on the private writers forum, wishing that one was in there. Because the same problem with you, like none of the ships there just match what I envisage in terms of its role and its capabilities, you know. So I've still got something to sort out there. Do I decide, I'm going to keep the ship, or am I going to modify one of the ships in the game, or, you know, what am I going to do? This still got that to figure out, so that's interesting.
I had a similar problem with the top baddie in the ship that they were flying, and I ended up sort of compromising on one of the ships that's in the list, and then basically saying, this one is seriously upgraded and customized and tweaked, and, you know, it's kind of like an uber customized ship. It's sort of a, you know, it's got the equivalent of a twin V8 supercharged, turbocharged, something under the bonnet. You know, it's that kind of super upgrade. It's almost unrecognizably tweaked from the standard ship, which I know you're going to be able to do in the game, but I may have taken it a bit too far that way.
in Elite, wasn't there a mod, I can't remember what the mods are called, the packages that people make, but didn't someone make a Super Cobra or a Cobra Mark IV or something?
Elite was quite good at that, so you can design your own ship and stick it in the game, and it's up to you whether you think it's reasonable or not. Some people have gone way over the top with some of the ships. You know, they're stupidly fast, they can turn stupidly quick. And you've got to have a ship that's got to be realistic, and I think that's the trick, isn't it? You've got to have something that you think, well, would that really happen? Is that believable? And you've kind of got to wrestle with that against the needs of what you need that ship to do. In my case, I needed to take, you know, I basically needed to surprise people because they kind of write it off as, oh, it's one of them, so it can't do that. And then it can do that, and that's kind of like, oh, shit, here it comes. and that's the impression I get. So that's the sort of effect I need that ship to have in that situation.
The main reason I don't want to change my ship, even though I might have to, is its shape is quite symbolic. I reference its shape, and, you know, it uses a metaphor quite a few times, while the versions of ships that are available in the game don't really have that same personality, shall we say.
Some of the names are interesting as well, aren't they? They don't lend themselves well to kind of, oh, it's a, you know, colloquial term, or it's, you know, something you might reference in a nursery rhyme or a kind of, you know, saying that kind of passes down from father to son. Yeah, I think some of those names need working on. So actually, another question for you, John. What do you make of the authors who've kind of disappeared?
I think I've sort of mentioned my feelings a few times. Obviously, if they've raised money on a crowdfunding platform, whatever it is, they have a legal obligation to follow that through.
Yeah.
In saying that, I think the wording on Kickstarter is quite particular. Mm. Estimated time of delivery. So you can say estimated time is March 2014, but it could be anything, really. And, you know, I followed a few Kickstarters, sort of a technology kind of type. And I think, by and large, all Kickstarters are late, pretty much. That's just a fact of life. They envisage, you know, XYZ will happen and it'll get done, but it won't. And with the best intentions, that could be 6 months to a year late. Some of them, I've heard some bad stories, like there was a laser pen for an iPhone or something, and it just went down the toilet, and they gave out the prototypes and they were crap, and then the company just sort of disappeared. And so those are the kind of things that happen. But generally, people are late, even though they've got the best intentions, not because they've turned criminals and run away with the money.
Well, I'm not suggesting they've gone criminal, but I think the thing is, you know, you've got, I mean, even if you're late, you can be given status updates, can't you? Like saying, yeah, I'm really struggling, the novel is 3 months behind where I hoped it would be, had problems here, and da-da-da-da. And I think in the early days, some of those updates did come out, but kind of now, you're just staring into a bit of an abyss, aren't you? And I don't know, I mean, I've sent a couple of emails to, you know, various ones, say, look, you know, if you need any help, do you want any guidance? Do you want some, you know, do you just want some kind of G-ing up? You know, because we're kind of all in this together. That's how it felt at the beginning. But, you know, there's just a void. There's no answer. And I kind of feel a bit bad on behalf of, you know, all the people who pledged to those projects, because, you know, we all made similar commitments, yet we will pledge to Elite Dangerous and get it across the line. And, you know, you'll get a book out of it as well, and the book's going to be this and the book's going to be that. And there's just a void. You know, nothing at all. Seems really weird.
It is unfair. I guess, again, they don't have a legal obligation to do that, but I think, you know, you would want to, as part of the community, and just as a general nice person, update if you can. Like, you've been in touch with someone and the conversations didn't go anywhere. You know, do you want any help? I can do some, you know, if you want me to review or edit anything for you, I can give you some pointers and da-da-da. And they said, yeah, that's cool, but it never really happened. I know that people are around, but, you know, a few of them have sort of hinted at external real-life issues and that maybe they're just bigger than what we envisage, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, it could be. I mean
knowing these people, I would say, and how enthusiastic they were in the Kickstarters, I would think that if they were able to update and be involved, that they would be my feeling. So if they can't, maybe something larger is at play here. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you can't prejudge because you just don't know. I think it's just... I mean, I suppose the thing I find is, punch out a quick email. How long does that take? Yeah, I mean, and I can appreciate life gets on top of you, but it's. I think if it was a completely voluntary thing and we'd all kind of just say, look, Frontiers basically said, yeah, fan fiction writers, yeah, you go ahead, go have some fun, knock yourselves out, and we'll pick an email out and tell people about your fan fiction books. If it was like that, then it'd be like, yeah, whatever. You know, it'd be up to each one of us to go and make as much fuss as we could. But these are official books. You know, people have paid money for them. People have paid money to Frontier to get an official license. You know, it's all contractual. I mean, the license from Frontier was pretty fierce, wasn't it? Yeah, that there was no bones on that one at all. You know, you knew exactly where you were with that contract. This is proper stuff. You know, there's several thousand pounds involved, hundreds of people, and money's involved. And at the end of the day, that to me is I can tell you sort of share that with me. You know, we take these things very, very seriously. Indeed, yeah, this is our reputation online. If we screw up and don't deliver, we'll never be able to sell a book again, that's for sure. you've got to take it seriously. You've got to take it seriously.
I mean, you're exactly the same as me, and then there's the passion for the subject, which is unparalleled on any other subject ever. I think Elite means more to me in terms of a fictional world than anything else. But also the opportunity as in the writing career. I mean, this is, you know, one step, and you do it right and there'll be a second step. And if you screw it up, there won't be. So it's in your own interest to look after it.
Yeah, do a great job. And, you know, this is, I mean, you know, I'm a big believer in living for today and not living for tomorrow. You never know how many you've got. You know, this is happening now. This year is the year of Elite coming back. You know, that won't happen again. This opportunity that we're in is a one-time offer. You know, it's happening now. You know, the fan base is roaring with approval of the latest stuff. There's massive excitement, loads of anticipation for the game. You know, that to have a book, I mean, and this is the other thing that just freaks me out because it's so exciting, and that Frontier are going to put aspects of our books in that game. I mean, you just look at that battle footage we just seen and think, some of the stuff in my book's going to be like that. And you just think, wow! And why would you not shove aside everything you possibly could to take advantage of that scenario? I mean, it's just
fully agree.
Opportunity. So excited, really, really good.
Shall we talk battle scene then?
I was so gutted with it because I saw it come out on Facebook and I was at work. I couldn't watch it because YouTube is blocked. So it's like all these people raving about this. I can't see it.
So I was reviewing the novel again last night. I had Psycho Cow in my ear saying, "Gotta watch it, you gotta watch it, you gotta watch it." It's like, I wanna finish this chapter first, but okay, I gave in and I watched it.
The same with me. My phone is set to ping whenever Facebook comes up with a message. And Psycho Cow was typing one word at a time and then pressing return. So my phone just went bing, 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 bing. It's got this kind of laser sound. It was awesome. I mean, I downloaded it, took it home on the USB stick and showed my kids last night on a Philly with a surround sound and a 14-inch screen, and they were just totally blown away by it. They was, is that what the game's going to be like? I said, that's what the game's going to be like. That's from in-game footage. You know, I know it's been edited and overlaid a bit, but, you know, that's what you're going to be experiencing. And they were just like, whoa, that is just awesome. And they were completely blown away and gobsmacked by how good it was and how immersive it felt. And I love the way Michael kind of promoted it. It was classic kind of English understatement. Oh, by the way, we've signed up a new composer, and oh, there's a video as well.
Yeah. he wasn't shouting that one from the rooftops. He was, FYI, here's a video that they used,
That was awesome. And the music, I mean, I like the music. It's kind of, you know, it's nicely epic, and it's nicely, you know, it fits well with what's going on there. I was just a little bit kind of, it's a little bit samey. I'm looking forward to seeing what else they come up with there in the quieter moments, because it was kind of like, you know, you've got the kind of orchestral wide big strings, and you've got the choral overlay and the kind of dramatic pauses when something happens. It's all good stuff. It's very John Williamsy. Wasn't, I thought there's an opportunity there for a slightly different tone, perhaps make Elise a little bit different, and I didn't feel it was as distinctive as I'd hoped it might be.
I was going to say, I got a big Battle of Naboo sort of feel from it. I guess the whole sort of flying in the Federation ship as well, but the music sort of cried out Battle of Naboo to me for some reason.
Yeah.
It was quite John Williamsy. And in saying that, I really, really enjoyed it. I can't remember the guy's name, but he did mention that obviously Star Wars was something he was trying to resonate with, but then go in his own direction. So
yeah, it was a name I didn't, I haven't done an internet search on. It was a name I didn't recognise. So yeah, it'd be worth seeing what else he's done. Because, I mean, that must be, for a composer, being able to write music for a game, that must be quite a coup. So I think he's probably pretty happy about it as well, by the way.
I'm sure that he is. But a question that came to my mind is, so you start with, in Elite you had the Blue Danube, and then in Frontier you had a new theme with a secondary theme by David Lowe, and then they brought in all this other classical music, which to me sort of, I mean, they almost kind of felt custom written for Frontier. They just seemed like the perfect bits of classical music to fit with the game. Like Ride of the Valkyries and the Hall of the Mountain King, they would have sort of seemed right, you know. And then, of course, they brought in the Quality Quartet for First Encounters, which I loved, but probably not appropriate for Elite Dangerous. So I guess my question is, you've got this composer, he's going to do all this nice new work. Are you going to keep all that original classical music in the new game as well? And obviously, Blue Danube will be there, no questions asked, I'm sure. Yeah, all the other ones be there as well. It's
I don't know. I mean, I got the impression. I mean, and I was never an FE2 FFE player back in the day. I missed them, as I pointed out before. And I've only really gone back and looked at them recently for research purposes. And you get the classical, you know, of course it sounds dreadful because it's done these really kind of 90s MIDI compositions of the music.
Yeah.
I wonder if they just put those in as background music because they didn't have to pay license fees for them at the time, and maybe they didn't have to compose
probably.
Classical music is quite an easy thing because it's kind of timeless, isn't it? But maybe some of the themes from that. I mean, I really liked in the Kickstarter video, you know, when they did that promo with the first bit of Battle Footage, and they just put the few first bars of the Blue Danube at the end. Maybe little tweaks like that. Come across a massive space station and you get a little sting of the Hall of the Mountain King, you know, just as you're coming up to it.
Yeah.
You know, something like that, you know. That might be a really nice little homage to the original game.
I see you've ordered a true English breakfast there. You going to pay for that one, or are you just going to walk out on this one too, like you did at LaveCon?
Yeah, this is really embarrassing. What happened there? I was at LaveCon. I had to get home reasonably sharpish, so I got up really early. Well, not early, but probably about 7. I got down for breakfast about 8, because we'd been up to about, I think, 2 o'clock in the morning the night before, so we were all quite knackered because we'd be playing Buckaroo with this, I can't remember the chap's name now, but poor chap, he fell asleep during the conversation, and then apparently, I didn't know this, but apparently what 30-somethings do when in the UK, when somebody falls asleep in a bar or a pub, is they just pile cushions on them and anything else you can find until they wake up, and it's Buckaroo race. The last person who puts something on them wakes the person up, loses. So it's just really, really stupid game, but it was quite amusing. And about 2 o'clock in the morning when we went to bed. So anyway, I got up at 7 o'clock, I had my breakfast, and you know, I was chatting to, I think it was Grant, who was the only person there at the time, and then Selezin, Dave Hughes joined me, and we had a brief chat. But I had to go, so I went out, and I went past the lady at the restaurant entrance and went to check out at the main, you know, the main reception. And I paid for my breakfast there, but I don't think it got communicated through to the restaurant. So Grant, basically, they came and got him and said, well, that guy who's just left hasn't paid for his breakfast. Grant had to pay for it. So actually, the Cheltenham Thistle Hotel owes the Elite community. So it's not me, so I'm holding my hands up as innocent, and I was set up by the Cheltenham Thistle Hotel. That's my defense.
Alright, that's cool. Alright, I gotta fly because my link is ringing. But one last question for you. And the last time you popped back to Earth, you stood on the London Death Ray. Was that pretty surreal?
That was bizarre. I mean, they've got this building that is south-facing. It must be about 500 foot tall, shaped like a parabolic mirror on the sun-facing side, which reflects down to the street below. And they didn't think that it would focus the sunlight. It's just a massive architectural fail. It really is.
Maybe they were Southern Hemisphere architects and they thought the south side would be safe, but then they put the building in the Northern Hemisphere.
I don't know what they're doing. But to stand in that heat is unreal. I mean, that is actually quite dangerous. It's melted a car. I don't know if you've seen the press stuff.
The Jaguar,
melted,
yeah.
The Jaguar did melt. I went down and stood in it when it was on. With the sun up, and it was 70 degrees centigrade. I mean, it was just mad. You couldn't stand there for more than about 20 seconds. And you thought, actually, I am beginning to cook, really. And, you know, for a couple of hours afterwards, I could still feel it on the back of my head. Yeah, you'd get serious radiation burn standing there in that heat. And the shop front there, you know, the paintwork was all blistered off. There was a rug on the floor that had been set fire to. You know, it's just really, really bad. And the thing is, it's going to come back because they said rather stupidly in the newspapers, it's down to the position of the sun at this time of year, which some person just said, yeah, it's called autumn. That happens.
And see you next year.
And then somebody else pointed, yeah, but because we live on a planet that's going around the sun will return to the same spot next year, obviously, but also in spring, the sun will be the same part of the sky. So we get clear weather at that time of year, which admittedly doesn't happen in London all the time, but it does. The sun does come out sometimes. You know, the same problem is going to come back, and so you've basically got this intense, and it focuses. You know, this building must be, you know, not far short of 100 meters wide, and the whole power of that reflective panel. So you imagine something about 100 meters square, reflecting down to a patch of street which is about 2 car lengths wide. You know, that intensity, all that solar radiation zapped into 2 car spaces. It's a death ray. It really is. It's really funny to watch, but it's just one of those things that, you know, somebody missed it because of the nature of the design. It just has this amazing bizarre effect, but there you go.
Alright, that does sound pretty exciting. Anyway, got a flight, enjoy your food, and I'll catch up with you some other time.
No worries, John. You take it easy, and look forward to chatting you in the future at some point. Take it easy. Have a good trip back to where. Where are you going next, by the way?
Don't know. Check out the bulletin board, see what kind of stock there is. Slaves are quite an interesting topic right now, so I might grab myself some slaves and see where I can sell them.
Fantastic, fantastic. Good profits, and right on, Commander.
Right on, Commander. Back to you.
All right, then, well, as Drew and I talked about, the new battle scene. First of all, great to see the feeds giving it to the imps. Obviously, the way things should be. And it's quite clear at Frontier Developments who they think are the good guys and who are the bad guys. I guess the question in my mind is, the next recording of Live Radio, will everyone be giving Mr. Stabler some stick? Hopefully. Hopefully someone will step up and give him a bit of a poke. On a serious note, though, this is gold as a writer. The details of the cockpit, the innards of the Fed cruiser, the location of missile ports, the number of retro thrusters on the sidewinders, all these things are information I need to, you know, write down and feed back into my novel as well. And the whole thing sort of made me shiver, as I said, you know, made me feel like the Battle of Naboo. It was great music, everything just felt right. It was quite fantastic, and everyone's getting pretty excited about it, and bring on the alpha test, bring on the real game, it's going to be fantastic. So what me and Drew also talked about is Fantastic Books Publishing and what this means for And Hear the Wheel, obviously a professionally edited and published ebook. We're going to have professional editing, going to have the cover, going to have reviews, going to have reader quotes. It's going to be a complete professional package, infinitely better than anything I could provide by myself. It's going to be amazing. The final product is going to be up to the standards, and it's going to be the same product that Gallants will make. It's just whether I can get the same amount of fans and followers as Gallants has and get the word out there. And of course, word of mouth is what sells books. If I get enough people saying how awesome the book is, they talk to other people and they buy it, it gets the ball rolling. And with Drew and I able to work off each other, get that ball rolling and hitting the walls as we go down, we'll get more and more momentum, and Yep, this has just taken my excitement about this whole project just to another level. This is really exciting. Something else that's been on the DDF recently is slaves. Now, there's been a lot of conversation on the forums about slaves, quite heated at some points. I know some people are quite upset about the concept and how they're going to be portrayed in the game, and some people a bit more relaxed. I guess I should go on record. You know, I don't condone slavery in real life, and in the game it's not really something I'd do either. You know, I played Knights of the Old Republic, where you can choose to be a good Jedi or a bad Jedi. Yeah, this is your opportunity to become a badass and do all these naughty things that your oppressed id wants to do. But I'm still that guy that wants to play the good guy anyway. I feel bad if I play the bad guy. So, you know, throughout the game, I didn't really do slaves. In saying that, there's some exciting things happening, so I might rethink that. But generally, I'm not really a slaves person. In saying that, you know, I think Elite is dark, and you need to have that darkness available. You need to have it seeing it in your face. Elite doesn't shy away from anything. You know, Elite just is. You can like it or you can hate it, but you know, it gives you the whole experience. Doesn't hide anything. So if you don't like it, you can piss off. That's all. I find it quite interesting how they've differentiated between Imperial slaves and regular slaves. I'm not sure what the term is. Slaves and Imperial slaves. You know, we already knew that, I suppose, in terms of the narrative and what Michael Brooks had said on the Fiction Diaries. Obviously, Imperial slaves are special and treated differently. Getting thrown on passenger cabins, yeah, that's pretty sweet for them. Obviously, a pain in the ass for the commander transporting them, which leads into some other points. You can free slaves with both good and bad repercussions. Imperial slaves might not want to get freed, but normal slaves would probably quite enjoy being released. And the opposite, you can have passengers and you can sell them as slaves, and if they either get released, they're going to come back and want to kick your ass. You know, it all depends on where you're at, what markets are available, what the world conditions are. Some places might be desperate enough to buy spoiled slaves. I mean, back in Frontier and First Encounters, you brought slaves, you didn't have Kagabel life support. As soon as you went to hyperspace, they turned to fertilizer. Now they've taken that to the next level, when you can get dead and soiled, and people might buy soiled slaves as fertilizer. If they're desperate, they might buy dead slaves as meat because there's not enough, there's a famine or whatever going on. So I'm just loving, you know, how they've taken the old game and expanded everything. And the narrative options is just great. You know, I'd love to see what rolls out of this in this live and updating Elite Dangerous Universe. So there's a newsletter that came out about a week ago, which sort of focused on space stations. So good to see the Coriolis space station still going to be in the game. That's what it was sort of given in my mind. Quite like some of the concept art that's done here. Definitely getting a Babylon 5 vibe from this one. Quite a strong connection there. Other people picked that up, obviously. But I like the fact that it's modular. So you can, when that's part of procedural generation, you have a bunch of bits and then a formula tells you how to arrange those bits. So whether that's it's a natural extension. But I like how instead of just being a solid shape, even in Frontier, they had orbital rings that spun around. So you thought, oh, yeah, that makes sense. It's got gravity, da da da. But it was still just a dumb block, and now they're going to actually bring in agricultural modules and science modules and sensor bits. So they're bringing it more to life, make it look more real. It's not just a dumb block anymore. And there'll be a million different variations of how they look, which is fantastic. And obviously you're going to have a space station. You're also going to get shipyards and asteroid bases. That's fantastic. I've always wanted one of those, and I won't ruin the novel, so I won't go into that. But obviously that's important to me in my novel. And like the docking ring, shall we say, where you actually, the docking cylinder. For those of you who played 68,000 versions of Elite, you know, Atari and the Amiga, you'd go through the portal and you'd end up in this sort of space where all these ships that were just parked up there and the engines turned off. And that gave a feeling of depth to the world, because here are the other ships doing their own thing, cruising around, docking at space stations just like you. The game doesn't just revolve around you. There's other people in it as well that sort of help provide a bit of depth. And hopefully this new docking cylinder will bring that same feeling to the new breed of players. I think it's quite a cool feature that, well, obviously we've known that space stations are going to be built. Where there wasn't a space station, they're going to start building space stations if the money's there and the economy's up to it. So being able to see these things progressing will be quite exciting as well. It's funny that the newsletter sort of talks about the Federation supercruiser and mentions that they're not invulnerable and may sometimes call upon players to help them. And then, of course, we get the battle movie where exactly that happens. So that was a bit of foreshadowing there, perhaps, that I didn't pick up on. It's interesting how they talked about gravity. In one of my last newsletters, I think I talked about, in terms of the passenger liners, how the higher class citizens and passengers deal with the lack of gravity on the spaceships. And now we're talking about the gravity on the space stations and the variation there. So obviously when the game starts, you're not going to walk inside a space station, but at some point you are. And so how's that going to affect you? You go to a place that, like a retirement village space station, which has low gravity. When you're walking around it, are you actually going to experience that lower gravity? Is that going to affect anything at all? Likewise, if you go to a 2G space station, is there going to be a medical station you could stop in at to catch your breath because it's too hard to go there? Or would you just stay in your spaceship? I don't know. But there are some good options there, so I'm pretty excited about that as well.
So, Jamie, welcome to the show.
Hello.
I've been meaning to catch up with you for a while, Jamie, so why don't you start with maybe telling us a bit about yourself?
Well, I'm an actor mainly, but I also beaver away doing various other things, like I write, I draw and paint a bit as well, and I compose.
And so you've got a bit of a treat for us today. Would you like to introduce that for us?
Yeah, well, this is something... this has been doing the rounds on the forums for a little while now, so apologies to your listeners if you've heard it before and you're already possibly vastly sick of hearing it. But this is my rearrangement of the old Frontier Elite 2 main theme, originally composed by Dave Lowe. I hope you enjoy it / are able to endure it. Thank you.
And what inspired you to compose this, you know, besides the obvious, being elite?
Well, I've always been a fan of the games, as I'm sure kind of pretty much all of your listeners probably are as well, being part of the community. I played Elite originally, I played Frontier in the early 90s. And this theme, when I listen to it now, its main appeal is nostalgia. Personally speaking, I don't find it musically hugely interesting, and I'm sure to an extent that was due to the limitations of the hardware and software that Dave Lowe was working with in the early 90s. But I just thought it would be really fun to kind of take the main theme, which is it's quite simple. It's all kind of roots and fifths and things, which doesn't create a very flowing thing. But the jagged kind of feel it does create it has a sort of military feel, which I'm sure is entirely the kind of thing that Dave Lowe was going for originally. But I just thought it would be quite a nice idea to take that main theme, basically, and then just give it some really rich, complex orchestrations behind it. And so that's what I've done. I've tried to just give it a bit more of a symphonic vibe, some nice, dense orchestrations. And I have tinkered with the chord progressions a little bit here and there, and... in a small way, I've tinkered with some of the musical structure a bit. But I just thought it'd be really fun to redo it and kind of give it some orchestral beef, if you like. So that's why.
Now, I'm by no means a music expert, but you know, just listening to it, feels like there's a lot of layers and a lot of instruments in the piece. You know, what guides you in your creative moments? How do you decide, you know, what instrument you're going to use and where you're going to put it and how many you want and you know, the overall sort of architecture of it. How do you figure that out?
Yeah, well, that's kind of a personal thing, really, in terms of the amount of stuff going on there. I just really enjoy density in music. I love it when you listen to something. I'm always quite distrustful if you listen to a piece and you enjoy it straight away, and then you listen to it again and then you very often don't discover anything else about it. I'm much more reassured if I don't like a piece straight away, and this doesn't really apply to the Frontier tune, I'm talking very generally here. And but then there's loads of layers. You know, you listen to it once, and you go, you listen to it again, and go, oh, there's that going on as well. And then you listen to it, and there's more, and you keep looking deeper, and there's more and more going on. It's like one of those fractal zooms. You know, the closer you get, there's more detail there. I get very excited about that kind of thing in music. And so most of the stuff I write, whether it's fairly conventional like this, or if it's really weird, I like lots of detail as opposed to minimalism, which perhaps isn't terribly fashionable these days, but I do like lots going on. As for what guides me, there's various rules, if you like. I'm doing air inverted commas there, of you know, music theory and things like this, which you can adhere to or defy if the whim takes you. But then beyond that, I don't know, I think it's just intuition, really. Obviously, this piece in particular is heavily informed by the great scores of Yore. That's Y-O-R-E, not, you know, Yore, not that old of times past. The big sci-fi scores by composers like John Williams, Jerry Goldsmith. They're, in terms of the film scores, they're kind of my heroes. But then classically, I like people like Stravinsky, Lutosławski, and all these guys, you know, have probably informed my musical choices. As for the instruments, again, it's sort of intuition, but there's kind of a common sense to it. Like if you're writing something belligerent and powerful and menacing and aggressive, you're probably not going to score it for glockenspiel, unless you're being excitingly experimental or something, which is also fun to do. But for a piece like this, which is relatively conventional, relatively derivative, you're going to give it to trombones and tubas and celli and double bass and things like that. That just gives it some more power and can give it a really, you know, beefy crunch. And so that informs the decisions of instruments to an extent. But a lot of it is just, I'm quite good at hearing music in my head and then figuring out what it is. And so a lot of the time, I just go with that. If I'm hearing a melody and it's on an oboe or whatever, then I'll write it for that. Unless something suddenly pops into my head to suggest that that's a ghastly idea. Yeah.
And yeah, should we be expecting more from you, or was this more of a one-off?
Well, I'm going to keep composing because it's the thing I get the most creative satisfaction from. Slightly less so with writing this, because obviously I was adapting someone else's material. I didn't find that as basically creatively satisfying as if I'm composing something myself from scratch. But no, I'm going to keep composing because I love it. As to whether I'm going to do anything else specifically related to the world of Elite, I don't know. I might do. But I don't know. That a lot of the pieces I've written lately have been a bit more conventional, a bit more film scorey, a bit more sort of adventuresome in a traditional way, if you like. So I quite like the idea of writing whatever I write next is going to be, oh, a bit nasty, a bit atonal, a bit discordant, a bit weird, which is, I suppose, where my soul truly lies. Yeah, so I don't know.
Well, yeah, thanks a lot for sharing with us. You know, good luck with the future, and you make sure you stay in touch.
Thank you very much. Thank you for talking to me. Bye-bye.
All right then, everyone. Well, thanks for listening. That sort of brings episode 10 to a close. I'm done with the Tiana system. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. Please tune in next time. Tell your friends. And here's Jamie's revised Frontier theme to hear us out. Thanks, and good night.
Uplink deactivated. Signal loss confirmed. Commander's log broadcast terminated.
We'll be right back.